File is part of the Swiss Libri Lecture Podcast series. Feel free to share it with friends, family, and colleagues, but we ask you to respect our copyright. So feel free to share it online, but preserve this message and don't modify the file in any way. Also, the views expressed in the lecture and discussion time are not necessarily representative of the views of Libri Fellowship.
Hello again, everyone. It's been a long time, but we finally got another episode out there. We've started term this August, and things have been very busy, though very fun. So that's why you haven't heard from us. Today we have a lecture given by guest lecturer this term named Jacob Marquez Rollison. Jacob's done a lot of work on the French theologian Jacques Ellul, and this is a lecture where he looks at a piece that's recently been published on Ellul tracing the theme of the desert throughout Scripture. So I hope you enjoy it. I found it a very interesting talk, and it'll start in a second.
So my talk today is called On Living in the Desert. It's kind of unfinished, it's worth mentioning. This isn't a finished and polished set of well-developed ideas so much as a series of impressions that I'd like to put before you for discussion. You might view it as if it's almost like I'm dumping a bunch of puzzle pieces out on the table, and then we can look through them together. Okay? So, why the desert? There's three reasons. The first one, as you all know, because I've talked to you all, except maybe Caitlin, who I haven't discussed too much with yet, because she just got here. I've been reading this French theologian, Jacques Ellul, for many years now, and working on his stuff. And he died 25 years ago in 1994, and his family has been going through the papers that have been sitting in his attic ever since. And so they're pulling out all kinds of things, all kinds of treasures, articles, full books, manuscripts ready, some not, some half finished, and the best ones they're publishing. And so recently one came out in this past year on the desert as a theme in the Bible and beyond the Bible. And if you're interested on him, I have written a little introduction. This is my wife's copy, but I brought one in. Richard's got it right now, I think, and it should be in the Libri library soon. But it's interesting for me that he writes something on the desert. He's also written another book, this one's from the library here, on the city, as a theme from Genesis all the way to Revelation. So he's somebody who pays attention to biblical themes and reads the Bible as a whole, and he also reads it very explicitly Christocentrically. So he has no qualms about finding Jesus in the Old Testament, even though sometimes he's criticized for that. The first reason I'm talking about the desert is Ellul's essay on it. And now it's been translated, it's going to be published in English, and I have to write something on it. So this is part of me working through what I'm going to write. Second reason is a bit more personal. The desert as a theme can also include ideas or concepts of dryness, of solitude, of barrenness, of being alone, of difficulty. And in a sense, for my wife and I, Melanie, the last month and a half have been, at least the last month and a half have been a bit of that. Most of you know that we're here because, well, maybe the most pressing thing that made us come here was Melanie had a miscarriage at the end of June. And so we've been working through some of our emotions and struggles after that. And so, at least in that sense, if not in a few others, it feels like a very apt theme in my own life. The third reason I think the desert might be worth looking at is, we'll come back to it at the end of the essay, but there's a question that's been raised in a number of theologians or other writers today of the desert of the Western Church today. I'll come back to that, but I just wanted to mention that as one reason that this is worth looking at, and it's a theme that can bring you into discussion with other things. So most of this lecture, what I'll be doing is just summarizing what Elul's article on the desert says, because I think that's a great way just to get all the themes on the table before you. And it also lets you see a little bit of how he works as a lay theologian, if you will. His PhD was not in theology. So the way he works is he looks through the Bible. He tries to find all the places where a certain theme comes up. He sees what commonality these different passages have, and then he tries to develop a sort of theology from it. So we're going to follow him on that path and see how that goes. So to start out, he mentions two biblical words, among others, these two in Hebrew, that often designate the desert. The first one is Yeshimon, and it implies solitude. It implies a wasteland, which in some cases can be caused by human action. And the second word he mentions is Midbar. And Midbar comes from the same root as the word Dabar, which is word, speech, or promise. And if you take these two things together, and both of them somehow imply the desert, you can see where the combination comes from of the word and the desert being linked together. John the Baptist as the voice proclaiming in the desert, or the voice in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord. Elul suggests that this link does not just come straight from the etymology itself, but actually follows Israel's experience living with God and traversing the desert. He also notes that not only John the Baptist, but elsewhere, there are many biblical narratives where people, the Israelites, or prophets go into the desert to receive the word from God. So with that as a kind of introduction, he divides the essay into two parts, and that's how we'll be looking at it today. So the first part is what the Bible says. So I'll be giving you a list of some of the themes that are associated with the desert, but also some of the main places in the Bible where the desert is addressed. And then second, the sort of constructive putting together of a theology of the desert. Okay? Sound good so far? Okay. So first, what the Bible actually states about the desert. We can see first that the desert is a place of temptation and of meeting. In that sense, it's ambiguous. It's not one or the other, but somehow always both and. It's good because that's where man meets God. It's bad because it's a place of absence, of deprivation, of void, in a sense of chaos. And in that sense, it's both a promise and a threat. It's a promise because God promises that's where he will meet you, he will encounter you. But it's a threat because, well, for a number of reasons, but one of them, all the way through the prophets, you see that God warns them in judgment, I will reduce your city to a desert. So there's the threat that the desert might come back, that everything might go back to desert, if you will. Both demons and God live in the desert, or are met in the desert by us. But again, from our side, humanly, it's a place of weakness. We're alone. It's a place of solitude, no civilization. It's a place where there's no food. But it's also a place of human initiative. And we'll get back to that later. So with those themes in the background, let's take a look now at some of the actual biblical texts that treat the desert. Again, I suggest that you take these not so much as here's the decisive list of everything that there is, as here's a start for your study of the desert. Here's a couple impressions. Let them all combine, pile up, and then we'll distill an idea of the desert after. So the first one, Elul actually finds the desert in the creation narratives, because you find the same combination of word and void or absence or formlessness, literally. In Genesis 1, there's the in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and void. That in Hebrew, it's tohu wa bohu. Elul sees that as this nothingness that only the word of God, only God's promise can shape and form and give form to. Next, Elul sees the desert with Abraham. Abraham is called and chosen from Ur, his homeland, and God tells him to go cross the desert and go to the place that God will show him. What's interesting there, and later in our own lives, is that the desert is between what we leave and the promised land where we're going. So for us, you might say the desert is between what we were and the kingdom of God ahead of us. As such, it implies a break, a rupture, and a change with what was. But also, for Abraham, it implies the promise. Note that God doesn't tell him much about this land where he's going. He doesn't even tell him it's going to be a lot better than where you are. He just says, go to where I'm leading you. And Abraham goes. So he has God's word, and basically God's word alone, to get him through the desert. Next, Elul highlights Ishmael, one of Abraham's children. And if you remember the story, God promises Abraham a child when his wife is very old, and she laughs because she's 9 years old. And so afterwards they think, well, okay, I'll give Abraham my slave, and he can have a kid with her, and that kid will be attributed to me, and maybe that's how it's going to work. And so with Sarah's slave Hagar, Abraham has the child Ishmael. And Ishmael is a wild man who decides to live in the desert. And Elul notes that Ishmael's name means God will hear. Now, in a sense, Ishmael has no future because Isaac is the child of promise. Isaac is given a future because God promised that it is through Isaac that Abraham's promise would be realized. But God does not abandon Ishmael. He does hear the cries of Abraham, Hagar, and Ishmael himself. And so God does hear Ishmael, even in the desert. Next, the desert pops up with Moses. With Moses, God is actually the God of the desert in a way, because Moses is feeding his flocks in the desert when God appears to him in this burning bush. Elul notes that the desert in this case is not the city. It's a very different thing because there's no confusion. There's a very clear separation. The spiritual reality becomes clear in the desert, which we'll see pop up later again. He also notes that with Moses, God can only be worshipped in the desert, which is why Moses has to continually say to Pharaoh, let my people go into the desert to worship our God. It's implied that they can't do that just staying in Egypt. Next, probably the most significant and long-standing one in the Old Testament, is Israel in the desert. We see that they go into the desert upon their exodus, their leaving from Egypt. And now Egypt in Hebrew is Mizraim, M-I-Z-R-A-I-M. And this means double anguish, or Egypt is the land of double anguish. Elul sees this both as they're enslaved, but they're also sort of anxious, alienated. And so leaving Egypt for Elul marks both an entry into freedom, because they're no longer slaves, but also into hardship, because there's nothing, no structures, no city in the desert to sustain life. So what's interesting is that in doing so, Pharaoh, first, he thinks this is perfect. Israel's lost. They're going into the desert. I've got them. But Pharaoh has no power in the desert, does he? God doesn't even let him enter. The Red Sea forms a barrier that Pharaoh and his armies can't cross. So in a sense, you could say there's only spiritual battles in the desert. Pharaoh and human means don't have any sway there. You can only live in the desert by the active presence of God. And this is against Pharaoh's expectations, as we saw. So why then the desert? Why, when God leads them out of Egypt, do they spend all this time in the desert? The Old Testament does explicitly give us an answer in Deuteronomy 29:6. It says, so that you might know that I am the Lord your God. So they have to pass through the desert because, in a sense, you might say that if they didn't, they could always say, oh yeah, it was this other thing that got us through. It was this other thing. But now, because they passed through this time where there's literally nothing, if they make it, they know the only reason they made it is because the Lord their God made them make it. And so going through the desert creates faith. Elul goes as far as to suggest that after this, Israel's entire theology is built on this desert experience. Think of all the times throughout the Old Testament where God says, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. He said, in the Psalms, he says, don't harden your hearts as your fathers did in the desert when they tested me and I swore in my anger that they will not enter my rest. So, yeah. So far, what do we have? Elul has traced this theme of the desert where he found it in the creation account in that tohu wabohu, then in the election and the call of Abraham, next in the revelation to Moses, and finally in the liberation from the slavery in Egypt. What comes next? The book of Numbers. The book of Numbers, we call it Numbers because we have the Latin title, but the Hebrew title is Bar Midbar, in the desert. So the desert is literally in the title of this book. There are several themes that overlap in Numbers. There's the theme of holiness, and that's why you get all the codes of holiness, the laws of being separate. And God says, because I am holy, a number of times. There's a sense in which we see Israel's life in the desert, which involves several problematic parts, such as rebellion against God and what he says, and a looking back to Egypt and in a yearning way. And then also there's a sense in which Joshua is an enormous foreshadowing of Jesus, especially not least in his name, because Jesus is basically the Greek version of Yeshua, which means Yah will save, so God will save. And then also there's this sense in which the sacrifice needed for life is another big foreshadowing of Christ, and that comes in chapter 28 of Numbers. In Numbers, we also see that the desert is the place of non-establishment, of not being settled down. And afterwards, when Israel does manage to set themselves up in Canaan, this unsettledness is still represented there by the Levites. They're God's priests, but they have no land themselves. In a way, they always live in the desert as Levites. Finally, Elul notes that especially since this the word desert makes it into the title of this book, he thinks that this book is written later, and as such, it kind of represents a theology of the desert on the part of Israel. So when they're setting this book up and putting it together, you realize it recounts a lot of the same history as the other early books. So there's a reason that they're setting this one up as they do. So after Numbers, Elul notes the idea of the scapegoat and the purifications, because the scapegoat is one whom they lay all the sins of the people on, and the goat, and then they send it away, and the goat carries the sins of the people of Israel into the desert. So here's a ritual or an institution that carries these things off into the nothingness that surrounds them as a way of purifying the people. After that, there's a very significant text that I like a lot, the desert in which Elijah flees after he's threatened, his life is threatened by Jezebel. She basically says, I'm going to kill you. And Elijah is really afraid, and he feels lonely. He feels like he's the only one left who serves God, who cares. And so he runs away. And I read through this story yesterday in preparing for this, and it's striking because it's a major parallel both to Israel's time in the desert and to Christ's temptations, which we'll get to after. First, because he can only make this journey into the desert by grace, by the angel's food that the angel prepares for him and says, take and eat, because this journey is too much for you. And so an angel gives him food twice. Then he goes 40 days into the desert, which is how long Christ fasts, and 40 years was how long Israel was there. And so this 40 is kind of a time of temptation. And Elijah has no power left. He's afraid for his life. He's ready to die. He seeks refuge. And he's also giving everything up, kind of, all at once. But then in this time in the desert where God meets him, he receives a new mission. And God meets him not in overwhelming, scary power, but in a quiet, gentle whisper. Next, Elul kind of skips over a lot. Again, this essay is not finished, so it's possible that he intended to come back later to the prophets, but he just skips right to Jesus. And he does address the temptation of Christ in the desert. He notes that this immediately follows Christ's election and, if you will, revelation as the Son of God, where God says, in the book of Matthew at least, God says, "This is my Son in whom I am well pleased," who pleases me, right after he's baptized by John the Baptist. And then the Spirit carries him away into the desert, where he fasts for 40 days, and then he encounters three temptations. This being brought away into the desert includes his despair. It includes, at least in the case of Elijah, but also I think in the case of Jesus, according to Elul, a will to die. There's no guarantee. There's a sense in which he's totally on his own. God isn't necessarily supporting him with him, hence the temptation. In a sense, God is present only by grace, only because God decides to be present. Now, Elul thinks that these three temptations summarize all human temptation. The first one, turn stones into bread. If you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. Elul sees as the economic temptation. And for him, everything that we could say about contemporary consumer culture is included right there. The next one is a political temptation. All the kingdoms of earth I will give to you, says Satan. Which is exactly what Jesus is predicted by the prophets to inherit as the Messiah. In a sense, he's supposed to inherit all the nations. We can think of Psalm 2, where he dashes the nations in with an iron rod, and it's him who has the authority over them. And next, there's the spiritual temptation of show yourself to be the Son of God. Prove that you are the Son of God. You are, so why not just act on it and demonstrate it? Which, again, is exactly what Jesus Christ came to do. So in all three of these temptations, what is the temptation? In a sense, the temptation is for Jesus to accomplish by his own means and in his own time God's purposes, which God will accomplish by God's own means and in God's own time. So the purpose itself isn't bad. There's nothing wrong with eating bread. There's nothing wrong with Jesus governing all the nations, and there's nothing wrong with Jesus showing himself to be the Son of God. But there is something wrong with him trying to seize that power or grasp it himself. If you note, there's a parallel with Elijah there, I think, in the fact that when Elijah is hiding in the desert and he's in this cave, God says to him, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" And Elijah says, "Well, I'm sad, I'm depressed, all Israel has forgotten your covenant, they throw your altars to the ground, I'm the only one left who even cares." And God says, "I'm going to pass by." So Elijah listens, and there's a wind that's so powerful that it splits the rocks. There's an earthquake, and there's a fire. All three big, powerful, scary things in themselves. But the text says that for each one of these, the Lord was not in them. But then after that, there's the translation here is lovely. Some of the English translations say it's a still small voice. In the ESV, I found a footnote yesterday that suggests it might be translated as a thin silence. In certain French translations, it's the whisper of a murmur. So either way, it's this tiny, tiny, almost silent voice, if you will, but somehow Elijah hears it. So he covers his face and he goes out to the front of the cave. And what happens? Nothing new, only what has already happened. God says to him, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" And so God meets Elijah in his despair, in his sadness, and he gives him this new mission. So anyway, those three things which in themselves are powerful and scary, but God is not in them, are temptations for Elijah to... You see? Anyway, I think that's a nice parallel. But Elul adds a parallel too. Elul views this as a parallel of... Like, he views Christ's temptation in the desert as exactly mirroring Christ on the cross. Because he's alone, he's thirsty, so there's the economic temptation of hunger and thirst, there's the power temptation because people say, if you are the Son of God, come down from there, or call legions of angels to save you. There's these provocations and this question of power as well. And there's the abandonment, this notion that God has somehow forsaken him. So, there's that. A few last comments before we finish this section. In the desert, a little notes, the spiritual reality is clear, as opposed to the city where things are confused and easily confusable. He notes that the desert is a place of obedience, as Jesus obeys the word of God that he knows. And then finally, a little notes that the desert includes both the possibility of human failure and the possibility of God's abandonment as Jesus experiences it on the cross. So, I'll stop that Bible section there of what Elul finds either explicitly or implicitly said about the desert in biblical text. And we'll move on to this sort of constructive theological part where he says, okay, so what does that give us? Is there some kind of teaching on the desert? Is there something we can derive from that about the desert? Sorry? Yes, the last few. Yes, so he notes that in the desert, the spiritual reality is clear. He says it's a place of obedience. And he notes that it includes the possibility of human failure and of God's abandonment. And in that, he's deriving that from Christ on the cross of, why have you forsaken me? Sure. So, in the theological perspective, not just restricting ourselves to the Bible, in part, yes, but not only. We know that Paul, after he's converted, before he goes to Jerusalem and meets any of the other disciples, he basically has his own desert experience. I think he says he goes into Arabia for 14 years or something like this. I'm not positive on it, but I think St. Augustine, one of the first major Western theologians, has a similar desert experience after his conversion and before his ministry. And then in the 4th and 5th centuries, there's what we call the Desert Fathers. And this is a period where there are monks, there are these Christian thinkers and mystics, a bit mystic, who view the world and the city as this horribly corrupt thing, and they say the only answer now is to get out of it. And they go into the desert and they live a pretty ascetic lifestyle. And in fact, for this writing that I have to do, I did a little bit of reading on this. I have this book here by Thomas Merton, who was an American 20th century. I don't know if it's correct to call him a monk, but I think in a sense he did belong to a monastic order. And this includes his translation of a number of the sayings of the Desert Fathers. And so I read through these, and I can tell you they come out like proverbs. Sometimes they're really nothing special. It sounds like common sense, and it sounds like they're just, you know, sometimes saying a story that doesn't blow your mind. But I think that that's kind of the point, too, is all they go out to do is to meet God and be quiet and be humans before God. Though I will say that Merton compares them sort of to Zen Buddhist monks, which is, we will see a bit later. That's an interesting comparison. Second, I also read this one, which is in the library here. This is Henry Nouwen, The Way of the Heart. And he said this comes from discussions that they had at Yale University, I think, in the 80s, about the Desert Fathers and what that legacy might have to offer us today. And this one's very readable if you're interested. And he comes away with three big elements. The first one is solitude. The second is silence. And the third is prayer. And I think, given what I've read with Merton, that does accurately characterize the big points in the lives of the Desert Fathers. Solitude, silence, and prayer. Nouwen actually goes as far as to suggest that today, spiritually, our task is to create our own desert so that we can hear the voice of God again. So, yeah, those are two interesting resources, one of which is already here for you. However, for a lul, these desert fathers, it's kind of a mistake. Because for them, the desert becomes permanent. A lul thinks this is a misunderstanding, because with Paul and Augustine, we see that there's a return to the city afterwards. They go out to meet God, but not to just stay there on their own. Where by contrast, some of the desert fathers, there's some crazy stories. There was a one monk named Simeon Stylites, I think, or I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, who went out and built a pillar and lived on it for 20 years. And he just sat on the top of a pillar and lived and didn't come down. And people would go out to consult him. Some would bring him food. And they would ask him to come down, especially when he was sick, but he didn't. And there's even a story where he had some horrible boil or sickness or something, and there were like maggots eating it, and one of them fell out, and he picks it up and puts it back in. So there's some pretty intense stories. And actually, I will mention too, since this week Richard read us the thing from Philip Yancey about Tolstoy. Tolstoy got into these guys a little bit, and there's a short story by Tolstoy called Father Sergei, I think, Sergei. And it's basically an adaptation and retelling of one of the stories in here, from the Desert Fathers, about a monk who's tempted and how he responds to it in a very gruesome way. So, for a lul, this monk's living in the desert and not coming back to the city is a move that makes theology more abstract and separates it from life. And it becomes a kind of self-inflicted suffering. He also sees this as the influence of Greek and Hindu thought in Christianity 4 centuries after Christ. And that's why when Merton compares them to Zen Buddhist monks, it's kind of a parallel. So there's that. But then there's also a sense in which for a lul, there's a spiritual desert that is specific to the Christian life. For a lul, this is a feeling of God's silence. Now, it's no secret that a lul and Francis Schaeffer were not on the same page on everything. This is why, so Francis Schaeffer, when he writes, he has that book, He Is There and He Is Not Silent. He's actively saying, no, I think it's a misreading to say that this is God's silence. A lul in the 70s in France, he's wrestling with a lot of different currents of thought. And he has a book called Hope in Time of Abandonment, where he wrestles most directly with what he thinks is God's silence in the West today. And he clarifies it, and he says, now I'm not saying that God is not present in the life of an individual believer. What I am saying is I think that God is absent from the institutions of the West. He's absent from the West on a collective level. And we can explore that more if you'd like. But I figured I would at least mention that. So for a lul, once the Christian hears God's word, everything else is relativized. Nothing else has the same meaning that it used to. And it's, in a way, reduced. So, if you will, our natural state is a sort of idolatry. And so hearing the word of God brings these idols back down to just what they are, just simple things. And, that's a process of relativization, or what you might call desacralization. Things that we made sacred are now desacralized, no longer sacred. Elul views this as us being placed in a desert, if you will. We are taken away from Egypt, from all the things that enslave us, and we are placed in this tricky, dependent freedom with God. But then when this presence of God leaves us, when we don't feel it anymore, we have nothing but the desert, nothing but a sort of absolute desert. There's nothing left except a sort of night and perhaps silence. Ulul notes that in this state, our prayers might seem unheard. He notes that it might last for years even, as in the case of Abraham, who wants, who's waiting for his child, he's waiting for the promises. Or Hannah, who wants a child and prays and goes to pray before God yearly. But we are still commanded in this time to ask, to seek, to knock. And so if we saw before that the desert is a place of obedience, obeying is to keep seeking, keep knocking, keep asking, even though we feel like it's totally useless and that no one's listening. He notes that one big emphasis for Elul is in the prophets, they're commanded very often to watch and pray. But there's no point in watching and praying if you're not waiting for something or seeking something that isn't there yet. In short, you might say that the Christian life is not always happy. And that's worth knowing ahead of time. So then Elul poses this question. Do we absolutely need to feel God's presence always? Certain theologians have different things to say. For Elul notes that Thomas Aquinas and Calvin say, no, you don't. I can't tell you any more than that because I don't know those theologians as well as Elul does. But for Elul, he says, in a way, actually, yes, I think we do, because God is God with us. So there's a sense in which we yearn for, whether we feel it or not, we want it, and we can't pretend we don't. But he notes that God can indeed be silent. He notes times in the Old Testament where, for example, in the book of Judges or Kings, where it says the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Or there's the 400 years before Christ where there's no new prophets. There's nothing that's added to the biblical canon after the last prophets and until Christ. Finally, he notes that the Holy Spirit is like a wind who comes and goes freely. And the whole point is we don't control that. There's the question asked many times, can you grasp the wind? In Proverbs, there's something to compare something to say it's vain or useless is to say it's like grasping at the wind. You can't catch the wind in your hand. So then, what can we get out of this? What does this give us for our own lives? Elul notes that the desert, he sees this as an incitement to hope. When you enter the desert for Elul, there are no human means for the future, and you have a felt, you feel God's silence. You feel like God has left you alone or kind of abandoned you. So what do you do to respond? You hope. Can we hope for what we see? He asks. And I think Hebrews answers no, we can't. Or I think it's Hebrews. But along with hope, Elul notes that the desert is the experience of freedom, of human freedom. Now, for Elul, this freedom consists of three things, at least in this article. If you want to develop it more, it's some of his largest books are literally written on this. He has a 3-volume Ethics of Freedom. So anyway, here he notes three things. The freedom in the desert consists of, first, being unfocused on ourselves. He writes, quote, "The spiritual desert is serious only if my experience is the most important thing. And freedom begins with the freedom from this worry." So in other words, the freedom that Elul sees in the desert is being freed from our own, from the tyranny of what we might experience and making that definitive. We have a freedom with regard to what we see and feel, because if what we see and feel is everything, then God is absent and there's no hope. So to hope and to live in freedom is to be free from our own, from ourselves in a way. Second, Elul sees this freedom as a responsibility. We are responsible for our decisions. In a way, the desert is a place where you could turn anywhere. You could go anywhere. And that's why Israel gets the command of God in the desert. They meet God at Sinai in the desert. And he says to them, look, today I put before you life and death. Choose life. So he's giving them a choice. And he's encouraging them to choose life in his word. Finally, Elul notes that this freedom consists in exactly keeping those commandments. For him, these commandments are a sign of our freedom. And they are given by Moses in the desert. So, linking this to the temptations of Christ, he sees this as freedom from the economic temptation, from today, from materialism, from believing that we are nothing but bodies that act like machines and that work in a purely physical and material way. Freedom from our physiological conditions, if you will. freedom from the economic necessities or political necessities that might tell us this is how things work. For Elul, Christians are free individuals and neither slaves nor robots. And in fact, he goes in his Ethics of Freedom, he goes so far as to say that only freedom can properly worship God, which is why he sees this as a major theme in Paul's ethics. But we can talk about that more later if that interests you. So, to finish this out, Elul ends with a short section on the ethics of the desert. I'll give the few things that he says, and I'll just throw some of my own thoughts in there. And then last, to finish up my lecture, I'll just propose some ways in which I think this concept of the desert might be relevant to us today in the early 21st century. So for Lowly, ethics of the desert, the first is there's an ethical drive to criticism and iconoclasm. Iconoclasm literally means breaking the icons or idols, bringing things back down to what they are in their humble relative state before God. In his early years, he had a term for his whole theological project called Christian realism. He wanted to see things the way they are, not as not through our idolatrous eyes. And that's very interesting because in Isaiah, among other places, there's this language of those who have idols. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. Just like the idols that they serve. So proper seeing and hearing involves a smashing of idols, an abandonment of idols, and a return to God. Second, Elul notes that the desert is a place where we should worship. And for him, like Israel leaving Egypt, like Abraham leaving his homeland, this involves a kind of openness to one whom we recognize without fully knowing. So we never have the full story from the beginning, but we do have enough of a call to get up and follow. Kind of like Matthew the tax collector, if you will, when Christ says, "Get up and follow me," and he does. Next, Elul says, "Choose powerlessness." Now, in this essay, he uses the words powerlessness, but elsewhere he develops what he calls an ethics of non-power. And by non-power, what he means is this. Power is the ability to do something. Powerlessness is not having the ability to do something. And non-power is having the ability to do something and not doing it. And that too links to his interpretation of Christ on the cross. If Christ really could, at any moment, say, "All right, I'm fed up. That was one criticism too many. God, send the angels down, slaughter them all." If he really could do that, then the fact that he doesn't becomes a lot more significant. The fact that he doesn't just slaughter everyone in front of the cross is due to his own free restraint of the power that he does have, rather than a powerlessness as a sort of victim. So, again, with these temptations in the desert that are our temptations to take God's promises by our own means and in our own timing, this choose non-power or powerlessness here is our actively living by God's timing and God's means and not our own. Next, he notes that the desert is a place for holiness, as in Numbers, Bar Midbar, in the desert. It's a place where we are set apart. There are specifically Christian things to do in our lives. Christian ethics is not the same thing as just ethics for everyone else. Finally, Elul notes that the desert is a place for wisdom. And again, with the desert wisdom of the fathers, Elul notes not too much wisdom. But it is a wisdom to have not too much happiness, not too much order. It's a wisdom of refusing a certain excess, which today is probably a very important kind of wisdom that we could use. So that's where Elul ends it. I'll add one other thing. I would say that, he doesn't specify this, but I would say that the ethics of the desert is prophetic. Elsewhere in his writings, Elul thinks that what is prophecy? He thinks that, well, today, in a way, theological ethics is prophecy. looking at theology and saying, well, how do we live then? That's prophecy. And so for Lowell, what he means by prophetic is we live this reliance on the free grace of God against the false securities that idols can give us. And the last thing I'll note on that is, if there's one book of the Bible that formed Lowell's theology more than any other, it's the book of Ecclesiastes. And he spent about 50 years just digging into Ecclesiastes, meditating on it, receiving from it. And he notes that he thinks the book of Ecclesiastes was used as a ritual text for Israel during what's called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. And what they would do is they would go outside and they would build a little tent and they would move all their possessions from their house into the tent. And so if Ecclesiastes is read during this time, then really what this is a ritual, a festival that celebrates the fact that God is our ultimate dependence. And it literally reminds them of the time when their people were traveling through the desert. So honestly, if I look around, I think we lack that in our society. We lack a sort of lived experience of, like, an intentionally lived reminder of God is our only security. So that's enough for the Bible and for Lowell's theology. I want to finish with just a few more notes on what I think the desert, or ways that the desert as a theme connects to our culture. Has anyone ever heard the phrase, "Welcome to the desert of the real"? Have you ever seen the film The Matrix? Then you have. So Morpheus says this this phrase. Do you remember when? Does anyone remember? Okay, so when Morpheus offers Neo the two pills, basically the one pill that will say, no, no, I don't want any more knowledge, I want to stay happy in my illusion, or the pill that lets him, quote-unquote, see how far Alice's rabbit hole really goes, and Neo takes that pill, Morpheus says, welcome to the desert of the real. And the lightning flashes, and in the room, you see that there's a coffee table with some books on it. And one of the books is titled, you can see on the spine of the book written, Simulation and Simulacra. And that's a book by the postmodern philosopher Jean Baudrillard. And so if you look in Simulation and Simulacra, like, the filmmakers are clearly making this reference with that phrase. That phrase comes on within the first two pages of the book. And Baudrillard is using this phrase to kind of play with an essay by Borges, in which Borges describes a map. The relation between a map and a territory. And Borges basically says, in this short story by Borges, it's a special map where when you make a change on the map, the change is reflected in the territory. And so it reverses the relationship between territory and map, right? Usually you make a change on the map when the territory changes. But for Baudrillard, when he talks about the desert of the real, what he's saying is that today there is no more territory. All we have is a map that overwhelms everything else. And so we change the map, but we never go out in the territory anyway. So the map basically is the only reality that we enmesh ourselves in, and the territory behind it is nothing but a desert now. So the desert of the real, right? And then this same phrase is retaken by the atheist philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who uses it in as the title of a book where he offers a couple essays interpreting the terrorist attacks on September 11th in the U.S. In 2001. So, in a sense, what are we getting at with this idea of the desert of the real that has this massive pop culture and philosophical status? In a way, what we're saying is the sort of virtual or symbolic world that we have constructed has a power that it never used to. A power that really does shape how we live our lives. It does shape how we relate to the world around us. And in ways that are not always neutral, but are sometimes very problematic. Or at the very least, we could say they're worth interrogating and worth relating to critically rather than just acceptingly. And I think Libri is a nice place to talk about that because we do take care with how we use technology. We don't want you just sitting here scrolling while I talk or scrolling in the lounge while other people are around you. Libri has made choices to say, no, we're going to submit whatever symbolic or technological things we can do to the community we desire to create, which is not a neutral choice. In a way, that connects to Alul because he has been called in fact, there was a conference in 2012 at Wheaton College in which he was called, the title of the conference was Jacques Alul, a prophet in the technological wilderness. So in a sense, this idea that technology might have something to do with this sort of desert that the contemporary West lives in today is, I think, an evocative and provocative idea. Next, I will note that there's a sort of link between Babel and this technological desert, because in a sense, what you get in Babel is, in the theme of Babel in Genesis, you have both technological mastery and a complete breakdown of communication. And honestly, I think if there's any combination that describes North America, the U.S., especially in 2020, I think I think that one is pretty a forerunner, if you will. Another theme that you can weave into this, Elul has a phrase where he says, "Today our desert is the crowd." And so another thing that he's linking this to mass media technologies that really come to be prevalent and used prevalently in the 20th century. So when he's young, in the 30s, he gets invited by a group of German Christians to go to a Nazi propaganda rally. And he goes out of curiosity. And this is before Hitler has basically said, I'm going to kill all the Jews, right? So he goes and he's blown away. Not just by how, like, what an overwhelming emotional thing it is, but by how much he himself feels compelled to salute with everyone else. And so at the end of his life, in an interview, one of his students asks him, "So, did you raise your hand with everyone else?" And he said, "No, I didn't, but it was really hard not to." And so he realizes, wow, if I'm, like, he treats himself as an average person. And so he says, the average person is really susceptible to the power of this new communication, this new communicative situation. And so, in a sense, the crowd is the embodiment of that. The fact of being reducible to your coordinates in this mass media system, if you will. And so he says, he has a line where he says something like, whoever is not more rigorous than that system of technology itself is going to be its slave. And so he suggests that being a Christian today involves an asceticism without precedent. And he doesn't mean in the sense of a desert father where you go and stick maggots in your wounds and live on a pillar. What he means is like this sort of asceticism that Nouwen's talking about, where you spiritually need to create your own desert so that you are capable of hearing the word of God. And as Nouwen suggests, three great ways to do that are seek solitude, seek silence, and seek prayer. That might mean you don't, read your news feed 3 hours every day. But you might take intentional and planned breaks from it. Finally, the last one I mentioned at the very beginning, this idea of the West as going into an institutional desert. It's no secret that many churches on the institutional level are just failing in the West. They're in Europe especially, they're, for example, France, the Protestant church is an old dying institution that has a lot of money and is very happy and content in that state. In fact, they're sort of just waiting for the day that the last six elderly people stop coming so that they can fully convert into a museum, because that's basically what they are. Likewise, in all over Scotland, all over the UK, cathedrals are sold and turned into pubs, nightclubs, hostels, cafes, bookstores. That's not an unintentional or meaningless thing, I would suggest. In fact, I have a friend who worked for the Church of Scotland after she finished her theology degree, and she basically told me she was just losing her faith while she was doing it. I understand. So I'm not trying to specifically pick on these Protestant churches. I think, in a large way, evangelical churches are maybe just 30, 40 years behind, but they're on the same path. So when I said that this is a theme in certain literature, there's a relatively influential book from North America called The Benedict Option, in which a guy named Rod Dreher basically said, like, look, today, kind of like Thomas Merton and these desert fathers, today everything's falling apart. Maybe we should just go make new monasteries and find a new sort of monasticism as a response to it. And that book is one of many that raises this theme of what do we do in response to the institutional sort of crisis that the West is going through. So, in all of these deserts, biblical, historical, theological, contemporary, technological, institutional, what is God doing? I will finish by suggesting to you something from my friend Amy. Amy did her PhD with me, or I did my PhD alongside of her at Aberdeen in Scotland, and she's really smart, and she worked on the book of Hosea, and her PhD was in dialogue with an American theologian, an Anglican theologian named Ephraim Radner, who's contemporary, still writing today, and Radner basically says, well, yep, God has abandoned the church, all the institutions and their structures and our traditions are all that's left, and so what's Radner's response? Cling to the institutions and just hold on, despite the fact that they seem empty and dead, and just wait around for God to breathe new life into them. Amy reads him and she says, okay, that's interesting, but I think there's a better response, and I think I can get it from Hosea. So she reads Hosea, and I don't know what you know about Hosea. In the book of Hosea, God commands this prophet Hosea to marry a prostitute, because he says that's what it's like being Israel's God. Israel has played the whore. She has gone to these other gods, and she has forgotten me, her lover. And concretely, what does that mean? It's not as if all the priests and prophets of Israel had gone and slept with other people. What it means is, in terms of worship, they no longer worship God the way he wants to be worshipped. They no longer, their institutions no longer mean what they used to. So he no longer recognizes them. He lets all their institutions die, their feasts, their sacrifices. He says he refuses her prayers. It's a harsh book and really hard to read. It's heartrending. And so, for example, one of the things that's going on here is Israel does not attribute all the blessings that she gets to God who gives them. So in chapter 1 in Hosea, it says this. God is talking here. So, for she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She will pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She will seek them, but not find them. Then she'll say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time, and my wine in its season. I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. So again, you see this connection with what I was doing with Ecclesiastes in the desert. In the desert, there's no illusions. You only live by the grace of God. But in the city, you're tempted to say, oh no, I live by these other things too. You're tempted to attribute the stability of your life to the economy or the president or the political situation and not to God who decided it. So for us, the idolatry is a bit different than in Isaiah's day, but it's no less idolatrous. So then, what does God do after that? He says this. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, or kind of seduce her, and bring her into the wilderness, and speak tenderly to her. I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope, and there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. No longer will you call me my Baal, which was another word for Lord, but it was also the false gods that they were serving. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will marry you. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Okay. So, if we're in the desert today, whether individually or collectively, I think what we can take from this is that we can watch and pray and hope. We can walk where God's presence leads us in freedom. And we can actively wait on God to fulfill his promise, taking up what Richard suggested is a Labri standard of active passivity. And we can quiet ourselves in solitude and silence, listening for his still small voice, and not simply following the signs of power, might, or strength that present themselves to us. Okay, that's 1 hour, almost on the dot, 20 seconds over, so I'll stop there. And I think that's all I had anyway prepared. So now I'll open it for questions, and we'll go as long as we think we have time, or until they tell us to stop. So like I said, I dumped out a lot. Now it's up to you to see what you want to explore or put together. Yeah.
Can you talk some about how you see sort of this year and the COVID crisis and sort of the state of desert and how you see them going together?
That is a great question. The COVID crisis, in a way, it did strip us as a church in many, many, many cases of the physical presence that we share with one another. And at best, we replaced it with a technological intermediary. And in fact, Melian and I in our church group, every week we had at least usually like a 3 or 4 hour Zoom meeting with the people in our group. And if you've done that, you know how lame it is. You know how Zoom is not a substitute for sitting around a table. And in fact, one of the big questions this raised for us was, do we still somehow try to do communion? Do we still take, the bread and the wine? And I admit that I didn't have a great response at the beginning. I didn't know what to think. And so I chatted with my friend Amy about it, the one I was talking about. And she said, I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to silently lament, to wait and pray and watch and not take communion together, because in a way communion is a meal for the body, in its plurality. It's a family meal. It's not an individual meal. And so for her, this was a question of how much of our communion can we stuff into the internet? And, she thinks that, the physical act of the Eucharist or the communion, the bread and the wine, is a good limit to that. It's a good way of saying, no, yeah, we're talking to each other, but it's not the same spiritually or physically as when we're together. So basically what it does is COVID forced us. It forced that question of what does it mean to be present with each other as the church on us? And can the church really be the church without being physically together, without meeting? It forced us to figure that out. And in a way, I do see it as this kind of stripping where God says, okay, I'm not gonna, like, I'll let these institutions fail. I'll get rid of all the sacrifices, the new moons, the feasts until she seeks me with her heart. I'll bring her into the wilderness where there's nothing left, and then I'll speak to her quietly, softly. So in a way, I think it really could be interpreted that way as part of this sort of stripping. And so I think a good response for the church is to take this as an opportunity to say, wow, God, we are sorry for the ways that we continually abuse, what you give us, for the ways we take for granted what's nothing but a product of your free grace. Yeah, that's my initial response.
I think in response to that, I agree with what you just said, but do you think, but my experience has been the opposite of the church. I think individuals in small pockets are really going to a deeper reflection of what this time means, kind of as in a desert space and lamenting. But I feel like my experience with most Christian communities in North America and Europe was, okay, let's just take the form and then continue to put it online and not going to the deeper things. So we do church, now we do it, like you said, a 3-hour meeting online, and look, we're together as the body of Christ, but not really addressing the suffering or the lack of physical contact and things like that. So I guess I've been really grieved by churches that haven't gone to, or pastors or leaders that aren't kind of stopping and being like, wait a minute, instead of just taking what we do in person, we can model it through technology.
Sure. If I can say so, I think that you're right, because I think that in a way the COVID thing only showed to what extent most of our collective organizations had already become nothing but a spectacle. In other words, if somebody goes to your church and they can say, I could stay home and watch this whole thing online, why do I come here? Then the question was already posed in advance. But COVID raises that question to a new level, because we can't ignore it. If, I mean, this is most sensible, I think, on the level of mega churches, but the same is true of any church where somebody can walk in the door and leave at the end and not have been addressed by anybody or address anybody, but sit and watch something. And it does point to the poverty of our symbolic institutions like communion, because like I understand that, you know, taking the bread and the wine might be an argument against that, saying, well, yeah, they came, they didn't talk to anyone, but they still took the bread and the wine. Yeah, but if the bread and the wine is a little plastic cup of grape juice and a little piece of, like, a processed plastic flavored wafer, like, is that really that much different? You know? So, no, I think you're right that, in a sense, the problem is not with, the problem is with the meetings that we have already.
I also thought that I would support that idea that if our services or the services of the church can be easily, like, reproduced via internet, and people don't feel that they miss something, then something is wrong with the services.
Exactly.
So services should be in such a way that they can't be replaced by something else, like a digital copy. I have another question about the desert. Maybe it's a more like biblical one, which I came across several times. Is the idea in the Bible that in the desert it's a place of demons? You also explained that. And when we talk about this animal which has to be sent to the desert, I don't know what the name was.
A scapegoat. Yeah.
Scapegoat. Yeah, it's written there. It's not just only sent in the desert to die, but to in the desert to the kind of there's a name, and people suggest that it's like a desert demon or something like that. Do you come across your studies of demons or the desert?
So in that case, no, I don't know, because I haven't. I'm mostly going off of a little stuff here, and I haven't dug into most. Like, I've dug into some of the texts myself, but not most. But in terms of the desert as a place of demons, yeah. Likewise, in the Gospels, there's a man who the demons drive him off into the desert, and he lives alone. Or there's a guy who the demons drive him to live among the dead, among the tombs and the sepulchres. And so I do think that in a way that's very clear. Also, I think just the fact that temptation is linked with the desert implies that it's a place of either like temptation in a way already implies demons or devils. And so those are there. But there is also an authority that isn't granted to the demons or the devils or the powers, if you will. So notice that when Satan says to Jesus, I'll give you all these kingdoms, Jesus doesn't say, you can't do that. You know, in a sense, he recognizes that, yeah, maybe for this time, that's part of what falls under his authority or something like this. You know, there's a sense in which for a time, Satan has a certain power that he can use over these things. So no, I can't offer much more right now other than to recognize, yeah, it is a place where both God is met and demons. So in a sense, it represents the place where things go beyond just what they are physically or whatever, where it goes beyond our control, and it's only, like, it's a more spiritual battle, which is why we can't live there except by the grace of God. I don't know if that's helpful.
You said something about choosing powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So, in terms of choosing powerlessness, the reason that Alul, this French guy, is talking about that is, for him, he thinks that one of the big themes in the 20th century is the increase of technological power. And he sees a certain human mindset going along with that, which he describes both with his word technique. It's not just an increase in technological stuff, but it's a way of thinking that pursues control, that pursues the ability to shape and change things, and seeks efficient and like efficient like the one best way to do things kind of, and that's not a problem if you're, you know, building a building. Obviously you would want a better building. But it is a problem if you start to conceive of your spiritual life in that way, or if that starts to encroach upon your life with God or the community, which is something totally different. So in other words, the major theme of the 20th century in his eyes, which is the growth of our means for power, does nothing to help our spiritual condition, and if anything, might actually detract from it. So what he wants is to see people who are capable of still, yeah, sure, like if you want to use this machine, great, but make sure it's you that uses the machine and not just the fact that this machine does it better than everything else that drives you to use it. An example of that in practice was the atomic bomb during World War II. The sort of argument that carried the day in what he said is like, wait a minute, you mean we have this bomb and we're not going to use it? You see what I mean? It wasn't, wait a minute, is this somehow a new level that changes what warfare is? But the argument was, well, obviously this is the easiest way to end this problem. So in the Christian life, he talks about, money, for example, with this, for him, money is a means of power. And so choosing powerlessness means that money, it's not that having money is inherently evil or wrong or something, but it is that money often has us instead of us having it, in the sense of where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So for a little, what is choosing powerlessness with money? Giving it away. He doesn't mean that you have to give all of your money away. We see that Zacchaeus in the Gospels says to Jesus, I'm going to give away half my money. And Jesus says, you're righteous. You know, and he doesn't say, why only half? You know, no. So in other words, the point is that for a little, being able to give money away desacralizes money wants to say to you, I'm what's important and I am following my rules is what's going to bring you prosperity and happiness. And giving money away is where you say, no, God is my source of security and stability in the future. So that sort of move of going against the logics of these things that we want to believe in is a way of taking away the spiritual power that they have over us. On a stupid level, a very personal and stupid level, the same is true for me with coffee. I've been more or less addicted to coffee since 2014. And not addicted in the sense that, like, I need it every day, like 10 at a time. But, I do catch myself saying, should I drink coffee today? Oh, well, if I don't, will I be able to work as good, or will I, you know, I there's a sense in which in my reasoning, coffee becomes something that, no, I need it, you know? And that's the step where coffee changes from something that's a nice drink to something that takes away my freedom, if you will, that I see as a source of my ability to work or my life. So that's a very stupid example, but I think it says the same thing, kind of. Yeah. So one other connection that I will link to that is the phrase where Jesus says, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. He also says, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. And I think the sheep among wolves one is great, because what do wolves do with sheep? They kill them and eat them. And what do sheep do with wolves? Do they pull out their pistol and fight off the wolves? No, they die. And so Jesus is very consciously saying to you, you're probably going to die. And he's also, like, phrases like, take up your cross. It's saying, take up what crucifies you. Take up the instrument of your brutal death and follow me. And so we should not just assume that the Christian life will also lead us to growth in power or success in society or all these other things. In fact, sometimes the conflict or tension between them might be very, very strong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Two questions.
Sure.
First, did you have any coffee?
I did. Only a little, though. But yeah, I did.
The second is, you talked about the crowd as the modern desert.
Yeah.
In what way do you see it as similar to a desert? Because I wouldn't say that the crowd is like a great place to meet God necessarily.
Right.
Maybe demons, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. So for Lil, Lil's definitely got Soren Kierkegaard in the background, and for Kierkegaard, Kierkegaard's trying to bring the individual away from what he sees as this integrated society where, like Danish Christendom, basically, Danish Lutheran Christendom, where you're born, you're baptized, so you're a Christian. So everyone's Christian, all of society is Christian, and so it doesn't matter whether you personally love God or not because you're a Christian. So Kierkegaard is, in that context, trying to say, wait, how can I get people to actually take seriously the fact that there's a God who confronts us in our lives and who wants us to walk with him and live with him? And so part of Kierkegaard's attacks against the press, against newspapers, and his fights with them result from this and drive towards this end to call the individual away from their place as just, like, I'm Christian because I belong to the Danish society, to a place where I'm Christian because I relate to God in my personal life. And so for a lull, the 20th century, at least the early 20th century, is still an heir to that. In France, Catholic and Protestant culture, mostly Catholic, but until World War II, basically, is still such a strong thing that you can assume a background of Catholic values to a lot of discussions. There's not really, other than Jean-Paul Sartre and the existentialists, there's not really a conflict between being a Catholic person and a French person, or a French intellectual and a Christian. But after World War II, that conflict becomes a very real thing. And so today, in a sense, a little thinks, like when he says the desert is the crowd, the crowd is today's desert, in a way, the crowd is where there's nothing left, and where you are just, like, you are not an individual. You don't have freedom in the crowd, because you're treated as one of, like, in advertising today, you're treated as a subset of all the data that we can gather about your life. You belong to this class. You Googled this last week, so I think you might be interested in this. You know, these sorts of calculations treat us as not an individual, but just a subset of certain data. And so the crowd is where you have this nothingness, but if you're going to survive as an individual in that context, in the mass media context, you'll have to learn to rely on God to get you through it. And that links to what I was saying about, like, where this kind of need for an asceticism. He sees Christ all the time as, when Christ addresses the crowd, he does it in really ambiguous or ways that break them up. And then when he addresses individuals, sometimes it's very clear. Sometimes he calls people away from the crowd, pulls people away from the crowd. So this crowd individual opposition is a big key for Elul's reading of the Gospels as well. Did you have a question, President?
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the desert Christians, mm-hmm. the saints. I didn't really get why Elul saw desert Christianity as a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think like many of the aspects that he kind of sees as good in the desert.
Yeah.
That's what the saints were seeking for. So,
Can
you explain something
more? Yeah, so for him it's a mistake because they go to live in the desert and stay there.
So the physical place,
Yeah, I think so. The spiritual component of that would be going to a, like seeking God only in a sort of meditative ritual or mystical kind of thought, or something abstract. So for Elul, those things are important as moments, you're going alone and praying really matters. But the point of praying isn't just so you stay in your room 24/7. In other words, he doesn't want life in the city to be seen as somehow less than the life of the desert guy sitting in his room and praying. He thinks that going in your room and having the solitude, the silence, and the prayer matters, but it's not the end all. So for him, the difference between Paul and Augustine as people who have a desert experience and then come back to ministry or life is more instructive than the desert fathers who go into the desert and stay in the desert. See? So, and again, he views it as a Greek and Hindu influence on Christian thought, which he sees as foreign and problematic.
But I think it's based on a kind of limited view on what the desert Christianity was in early Christianity. I mean, in the life of Anthony, for instance, the desert is called a city because there were so many desert saints. They knew each other. They were visited. They were never far from the villages.
Mm.
They were in a day reach, basically, so people could go there. So it's more...
Undoubtedly, you're probably right rather than him, because I know that wasn't his forte. That wasn't something that he spent years and years on. Though I will remark that even in this Thomas Merton book, I don't remember if it's Anthony or one of them. One of the monks says I came to the desert to get away, and now all these monks are here, so I need to go away. So even there, it's problematic when it's a rejection of community with others for a little. I guess that's a good way to sum it up. I'm sorry, I wanted to go with Caitlin.
I was going to say, I've heard thoughts on that sort of narrative. John Mark Comer, preacher from Portland, is talking about how you can also look at it like a larger narrative of their desert fathers, they go away, and then there's another move of Christians who go into the city, and then there's another move where they withdraw, and then but it's over generations instead of over one person's life. So maybe that's another way to look at it too, that body of we're kind of going through that period a lot.
Yeah.
It keeps reoccurring.
No, I think that's fair. Actually, Hope mentioned that same person in lecture series to me, so I have to look it up. But I think that's probably fair too. And that's why it is worth considering if this guy Rod Dreher is right about a Benedict option. It's worth at least taking seriously the idea that, hey, maybe what's needed for this time is a more monastic, retreat from all the things that we do that don't necessarily please God, and just to rediscover the essentials of prayer and dependence on God. So it is very possible. I think that's a good response to this time. Jen, you had another thing to say?
No, just kind of in that season of debate between the desert and having heard this through others, also that I think one of my friends and pastors once said it's kind of these different extremes of when the form becomes the idol.
Mm-hmm. So
hopefully leading us closer to God, but, and it can be through desert experiences, which can be over long seasons, but when it is completely cutting ourselves off from the body and other things and only seeking this mystical aesthetic experience, that then is no longer. So I think that helped me. And the city then can also become an idol too, like where we, and it can be also a place where we meet God into. So those moments of whenever the farm becomes the idol.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the desert and the city, it's the link between them is interesting too, because I think, I forget now, but I'm going on bad memories of old readings, but I think in the book of Revelation, Babylon is described as a city in the desert. And it's interesting too, because the, a little notes in his book on the city that, biblically, the first city is built by Cain right after God says to him, you will be a nomad and a wanderer. And so what does he do? He goes and sets up camp to never move and builds a city. The last thing I'll say on that, which I think is nice, is, there's another French guy who's influenced by a Catholic thinker named Paul Virilio. And, he has a line where he's like, if you ever read him, basically every one of his lines is like super quotable. And sometimes they're like a punch in the face, every line. But, he has a line where he says, today with the smartphone, we carry the city around in our pockets. And, I think that's a very interesting way of saying the city is not just buildings, but it's a spirit or a mentality and a way of living too.
Just wanted to comment on that discussion about the going to the deliberately into the desert to seek God or to mute the noises of the city. It reminds me of Bonhoeffer, who said you can't stand the community if you have not been alone.
Yeah.
And the other way around, you can't be alone without the community. And he recommends this day, desert day, kind of a desert day, where you go deliberately into the desert alone. And I think this is something that, especially for today, this could be one of the main services we could do to the society, or it's the only way how we can really live through Christianity if we are known as people who deliberately go into the desert from time to time and come back, go into the desert and come back, because it's really hard to find to hear God in our everyday life. And especially now, thinking about Corona times, it liberated people from so many duties. Mm. And what did people do with that? Netflix was really struggled with their streaming capacity. This is what people are used to do, and we can serve the world by just going into the desert. And like those holy desert fathers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, on one hand they did those strange things, but they were also, as I know, like people saw a search for their counsel.
Yeah.
They came there and they asked them questions, because those were the people who were not so much distraught, but all these things like themselves could help them somehow. And if those holy people were really open for this, to give the counsel, that's good, that's deserved. I think we should really mute voices sometimes deliberately.
Yeah.
Like, what I did is the contract for my Wi-Fi just ran out and I stopped it. And for 1 year I had no Wi-Fi and the connection of my phone was very bad in this place, and it was liberating. I think that you are open even to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think to pair with what you guys were saying about the desert as well, as not necessarily certainly it's not bad in itself. It's interesting that this happened, these desert fathers, they didn't pop up in the first 300 years of Christianity as much as in the 4th and 5th centuries. What was going on in the 4th and 5th centuries? Well, Constantine. So in a sense, the gap between the world and Christianity became less palpable to them. And so in a way, they had to go find it themselves. I think they got suspicious once once the world felt Christian, they were like, wait a minute, something's not right here. And I think that's a very, laudable sentiment. Like, I think the minute things start to go perfectly well, like, if it seems like everything is accepted that we say, then maybe we should start to ask questions. Have we actually been heard? Have we said something wrong? You know? Not in the sense of no one will ever accept what you say, and if they do, there's a problem. We hope that they will accept what we say. But we certainly don't expect it all the time. And so when it's up, when being a Christian stops being in some way different, then it might be worth going somewhere else. Yeah.
I was just going to link it because it ties into what I've been reading with Dallas Willard and the Disciplines of the Spirit. And that also, having studied the desert themes biblically, and those points where both the desert can be a positive thing in our walk with the Lord, but also a very dead, a very hard thing where you feel the absence of that.
Yeah.
And you don't always feel like, oh yeah, I felt led into the desert, like you find yourself there. But then also, we can't always retreat to the desert. So also, these models that we see in Jesus and Paul and the early church of what you were talking about, that I can never pronounce the same word you were.
Yeah.
Silence, stillness, and prayer.
Oh, noun, yeah.
And that was one of the things Dallas Willard brings up, that was very much a model.
What's the Dallas Willard book?
Disciplines of the Spirit.
Thank you.
And then there are other disciplines of what it means to walk with the Lord, that early Christians didn't necessarily have to accept that, because that was something that was just intrinsically a part of day-to-day life, and just kind of, what does it mean? And I was rediscovering that during COVID, and part of why I'm here, to retreat for a desert, but also, what does that look like in a daily sense, where I live in a city, and I can't necessarily retreat to the desert as often as I want to, but how do I find stillness, silence, and other aspects of the Spirit, like fasting and other things, but trying to rediscover that in my day-to-day life, not just in the moments where God, like he did with Jesus or Moses or the Israelites, pulls us into those places. But it's also a rhythm we need to find in our spiritual
life. I think in connection with that, if this connection between the desert and our current situation is at all right or relevant, then maybe the work that is required of us is the work of Elijah. To listen to all these powerful, crazy things, but actually be able to discern that no, God isn't in those. To figure out when it is that, that's the voice of God speaking. And sometimes we don't have a roadmap for how to do that as much as we actually just have to open our ears and listen and ask God for help and ask his Holy Spirit to guide us and show us. So yeah, I think that in the city, it's especially problematic, in a physical sense, because there's more noise, but spiritually as well. Dude, you had a question? Or is it just hand exercising? Wasn't sure.
I'm
going to
ask a personal question about being in the desert. What is for you the difference between hope and having expectations about coming out of the desert?
That's a great question. And especially with this, with the miscarriage that Melanie and I have gone through and are working through, I don't have an easy answer at all. What I do have is a story of how I screwed it up. And so, in a way, like before the miscarriage, I was very, you know, I wanted to believe everything that doctors were telling us when we would see the doctors, and they would say, no, it seems just normal. You just have to wait. And so when Melanie was telling me, no, actually, I think I'm in the middle of losing this child, I was very tempted to, like, no, just be hopeful and wait. The doctors told us to wait, so all we can do is wait. And in a way, that basically, like, what I thought was a healthy and good hope that was allowing me to push forward, basically allowed me just to ignore my wife's feelings, which didn't help either of us. And so, like I said, I don't have a, I can't clearly draw the line between my own stupid confidence and true hope. In a sense, I would say that, like even during this time, I would say to Melanie, and this I think I was more correct in saying, is that, look, my hope is not that, like, I don't know, I can't say any more than anyone whether this is going to end in miscarriage or in the birth of a child. But I do know that Christ will be with us whatever happens. And I think that his word will guide us through even the worst moments of it. And yeah, at the end of the day, I think that's it. I think Chen just said, somebody said, yeah, you don't always choose, oh, I want to go into the desert now. It's more like, this happens and feels like God's not there and it feels like everything's falling apart, kind of. And I didn't desire that. So yeah, there isn't, like, even theology can be a very cold comfort sometimes. Because why does God say he's there when it feels like he's not so much? I think the answer to that is much more lived than intellectual. In a way, hope is what allows you just to not say, well, screw that, I'm done. Forget this Christianity thing and toss the Bible in the garbage. Hope is what allows me to keep saying, no, you know, even though I feel like I'm falling apart, I'm going to keep walking. And there's a wonderful line in the book of Job. I forget if it's Job or David in one of the Psalms, but where he says, though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. And, if it's in the context of Job, it's beautiful because it's in Job. Thank you, dear. It's absolutely gorgeous because the book opens setting up Job as the kind of battlefield between God and Satan. And so for Job to bring all his complaints, to bring all his pain, to say, I feel like God has treated me unjustly, to complain, to be absolutely wrecked and destroyed on every possible level. And then to have his friends come around and tell him, no, you're wrong. We know the truth, Job. You sinned, and that's why God's mad at you. And Job says, no, actually, I don't think that's it. And for Job to say, look, let's be clear about this. He can take my life. I'm still going to praise him. To, like, if there's a battlefield between Satan and God, that's the beautiful victory, is that God left Job free, and Satan was able to take everything he had. And Job still said, that's all right. Like, because the wager is that Satan says, Job's only praising you because you give him good stuff. And so that's the stakes of this game here, is that. And so at the end of the book, Satan's nowhere to be found. He just disappears after the first few chapters. But what does happen is God shows up and it changes Job's entire life. And that's not an easy book, but it is a beautiful book. Yeah. So yeah, on a personal level, I think, hope is something you have to wrestle with. It's not something you have it's not a formula, if you will. Yeah. Sure. For time, you want to call it there?
Yeah, we should probably wrap it up here.
Sounds good. Thank you. Very much. Thank you.